Welcome to episode 56 of Primary Care Update. I'm Dr. Mark A. Bell, a family physician and professor at UGA and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus.
I'm John Hickner, family physician and editor-in-chief of the Journal of Family Practice.
I'm Henry Barry, a family physician and one of the co-founders of InfoPoems. We are recording on July 30th. On this day in 1965, Lyndon Johnson signed the bill creating Medicare. Do either of you know who was the very first Medicare beneficiary?
Lyndon Johnson?
No. It was Harry Truman who, just interestingly, in 1945, proposed a national health insurance program.
Excellent. Thanks for that moment from history with Henry Barry. So on this podcast, we highlight poems, which stand for patient-oriented evidence that matters. If you want to get all of the poems, one a day, subscribe to Essential Evidence. And you also get a great primary care reference, lots of interactive tools and disease and symptom chapters focused on primary care, emergency medicine, and hospital medicine. Check it out at essentialevidenceplus.com. And as always, the opinions expressed on Primary Care Update are those of the commentators, and this podcast doesn't represent medical advice or the endorsement of any product. This week, we've got a large school outbreak study out of Israel to discuss some information on IgG and IgM antibody tests and their accuracy or lack thereof, non-drug treatment of hypertension, and syncope. So a lot to cover. We'll dive right into it. First study was an outbreak in Israel. It was reported in the journal Eurosurveillance. It was pointed out to me by a colleague at UGA, not a journal I normally see, but this guy was actually formerly the assistant surgeon general, so I think he tracks that stuff. Anyway, it's a very interesting study. Schools are struggling with this decision to reopen. In Israel, on March 13th, all of the schools were closed, and they reopened on May 17th with mandatory daily health reports, face masks, sanitizers, social distancing, reduced interaction between classes, in theory. As it turned out, the school in question didn't have adequate room for distancing. And during a heat wave, a couple of days after they reopened, the mask requirement was lifted because it was so hot in the school. They also had air conditioning running and recirculating air, which in other outbreaks has been problematic. School had 162 staff, almost 1,200 students, and they were all 12 to 18 years of age. On May 26th and 27th, so about 5-6 days after that heat wave, two students in different grades were diagnosed with COVID-19. They weren't epidemiologically linked. The school was closed, and they tested everyone. The attack rate by that time ranged from 17 to 33% in grades 7 through 9 and 2 to 5% in grades 10 through 12. They don't tell us, but I suspect that the original cases were probably in those lower grades. Overall, 13% of students and 17% of staff tested positive. Cases were symptomatic in 43% of the students and 3/4 of the staff. So conversely, almost 60% of students were asymptomatic. They also tracked secondary cases. There were 87 among family and close friends, including a number of older persons. As of June 30th, so about a month later, about a third of students and staff had not yet fully recovered. Nationally, the proportion of cases in school-aged children was 20% before reopening, and it increased to 41% after reopening, so more than doubling. Anyway, this is good information, interesting. Clearly, this is what happens if you aren't able to do things right. We still don't fully know exactly what's going to happen in schools that do manage to follow sort of ideal precautions, but this is what happens if you don't do it right. Henry?
Thank you. So we've been seeing similar reports from other countries of a similar nature with regards to reopening of schools and the implications. And the, you know, the National Academy of Sciences actually has just recently released a very large set of recommendations in great detail on how to try to safely do this. Even in those circumstances, doing it safely doesn't mean that people will be 100% protected. So we have to keep this in mind. The other thing I just wanted to reflect a little bit is that in terms of just evidence, case series and things of this nature generally go pretty low on the list of quality that we would use to answer certain kinds of questions, largely around treatment effect and prognosis and the like. So these are the perfect kinds of studies for trying to figure out things like the duration of symptoms, the duration of immunity and reinfection, which none of which have been answered yet.
Yeah, and I think it would be great. You know, I agree with you. I mean, these kind of outbreak studies are classic. If you go to MMWR, you'll see one in almost every issue, at least one. And they really make interesting reading. You know, I had my students write one of those up when I was teaching field epidemiology. Every week, one of the students would have to present one of the MMWR cases, and they were always interesting. It would have been interesting if in parallel they would have identified a school, another similar school, and done the same kind of testing to see what happened in a school where they didn't have these, that heat wave and the lack of masks for 3 days. So anyway, that would have been a good thing to see. John, any comments on this one?
Yes, in about a month, we're going to have a huge national experiment or natural experiment in the United States because schools will be all over the place in terms of policies and procedures. So we shall see what happens.
Yeah, I agree. The next one is a meta-analysis just published in BMJ a couple of days ago by Bastos and colleagues, Diagnostic Accuracy of Serological Tests for COVID-19, Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. And this meta-analysis identified 40 studies of tests, their serologic tests for IgG or IgM antibodies or both to SARS-CoV-2. They searched all the standard databases plus preprint servers for unpublished or unpeer-reviewed work. Studies were evaluated in parallel. It was a really methodologically very sound meta-analysis the way they did it. Study quality was assessed using the QADIS-2 tool, which is sort of the standard that we use in doing these kind of studies. Most of the studies were from China. Most used a case-control design and studied inpatients. So if you're interested in using these tests in outpatients, which is where they mostly get used, that lends some uncertainty. If you are designing a study of a diagnostic test, generally we prefer a cohort with unknown disease rather than a case control design, although in this setting that may not be possible given how widespread asymptomatic infection is. In any case, the risk of bias for patient selection was rated high for all but one study because of that case control design, and higher unclear for the index test because it wasn't clear that they were masking the researchers and laboratory workers. And they also, it was unclear whether the cutoff for an abnormal test was set beforehand or afterwards. There was a mix, about half commercial tests and half homegrown tests. The results show that the lateral flow immunoassays had really mediocre sensitivity, 66%, specificity 97%. ELISA tests a little better, 84% sensitive, also 98% specific. The best were the chemiluminescent immunoassays. There were 13 studies of these, 98% sensitive, 98% specific. All of these values are only for 3 weeks out. If you do the testing at 1 week or 2 weeks, IgG or IgM, you had very low sensitivity, like in some cases, 20, 30%. So if you're going to use these tests, the chemiluminescent immunoassays seem to be the highest accuracy. And you need to wait at least 3 weeks. I get these emails once in a while, and someone I've never heard, random hockey dad, I think the hockey dads, their natural habitat is Canada. And so I get this question from hockey dad, never heard of, says, so my kid's going to hockey camp and they're using IgG and IgM to determine who can go. Should I go? I'm like, thank you for the warm introduction. You know, he just sort of randomly, I don't know how he found me. Tells you that's a terrible strategy, right? We shouldn't be using that test to certainly not, you know, people sometimes think, oh, IgM, acute infection, but even the IgM tests were taken 2 to 3 weeks before they turned positive. So crappy studies of not great tests. If you're going to use these, use them in at least 3 weeks after the onset of symptoms and use a chemiluminescent immunoassay. And I will put, I got to figure out how to do show notes somewhere, but there is, BMJ has an interactive calculator. And so if you go to the BMJ, they published this recently that allows you to plug in pretest probability, sensitivity, specificity, and it does a really nice job of summarizing this. Also, this article in the BMJ has a nice visual abstract that's just a nice image on page 2 of the study. So I think that's worth looking at. John, I'll let you go first. Any comments?
Yes, this does not include in this review the new antigen detection tests. And those are the tests that are going to be point of care, immediate result tests. So we need more data about the accuracy, I think, of those tests, because those tests, I think, are going to be used quite frequently in terms of return to whatever. So we need to know their sensitivity and specificity. My guess is, I'm going to guess that their sensitivity will be not great and the specificity will be pretty good. So you'll be able to rule in, but not rule out. That's my guess. But I think we just need more data on the antigen detection test, because those are going to become in widespread use before too long.
Yeah. And when we have that data, we'll bring it to you. Henry?
So I just want to make the distinction between reporting of studies about testing versus the tests themselves. And I think you did a nice job of laying out the tests that performed really well and those that didn't perform so well in terms of the classes. And often the reporting really creates problems for us. And so some of these tests, like the chemiluminescent assay, may in fact be an outstanding test, but the reporting isn't very good. The FDA does have requirements in normal times for fairly rigorous testing and controls and the like. And currently those rules have been relaxed, so we do have to be a bit cautious. The last point that I want to make is the point that you alluded to, is that these were all done on inpatients. So those are the most severely ill, and that introduces the potential for something that we call spectrum bias, that the testing performs differentially based on the severity of disease. And that's potentially problematic, especially as we start thinking about reopening schools and getting people into jobs, because we are hoping that if they actually have the antibodies, that they have some degree of protection. The antigen testing is only going to help us to know, are you potentially infectious at this moment, where is quite often we need both kinds of tests and we need rapid turnaround on getting those results.
Thanks, Henry. Good summary. And thanks for the reminder about spectrum bias. And I think you have a quiz question for us.
This month's quiz is triggered by an upcoming poem on the use of a medication called Givosiran in the treatment of acute intermittent porphyria. So the question asks, which of the following statements about acute intermittent porphyria is true? It is a common, easily diagnosed condition. Two, most patients are symptomatic and frequently experience acute attacks. It is caused by a mutation in genes that encode heme synthesis. And four, no medications have been implicated in triggering acute attacks. Stay tuned.
Well, I think I may actually know the answer to that one. All right, I'm kind of excited. I have not read ahead, so we'll see if I'm right or not. So, Henry, you also got the next poem. It's a little bit about non-medication treatment of hypertension.
So usually when we think about non-medication treatment, we think about diet, exercise, weight loss, relaxation, et cetera. But this is a slightly different spin on it. This study asks the question, does catheter-based renal denervation decrease blood pressure in hypertensive patients who are not taking antihypertensive drugs? This was published by Bohm this past May in Lancet. The acronym for this study is Spiral HTN Off-Med Pivotal. Okay. I don't know where they come up with these. I thought acronyms were supposed to make it easy to remember the study. This is worse than just saying, you know, we looked at catheter denervation. Okay. So anyway, this was an industry-funded, multinational, randomized trial. It was single blinded, so it had a couple of limitations in that regard. They recruited adults between 20 and 80 years of age, and their office blood pressure systolic had to be between 150 and 180, and their diastolic pressure of 90 or higher. Those individuals subsequently underwent 24-hour ambulatory blood pressure monitoring, and their average blood pressure had to be between 140 and 170. Above 170 is associated with rapid decline in health status, so it would have been unethical to have an untreated group in that regard. These individuals had to be off medication for at least 4 weeks before enrollment. And then they randomized about 160 patients to this catheter-based renal denervation and about 160 to a sham procedure, right? After 3 months, what they found was that the patients who got this denervation, I don't know if what we call those denervated patients, unnerved patients, they had an average lowering of their blood pressure of about 4 millimeters of systolic compared to those individuals with about a 6.5 millimeter lowering on with blood pressure reading. So this was more than they got with the sham treatment. So ultimately what this tells us is there's a modest reduction. Unfortunately, the way they reported this, we have no idea how many patients would have no longer been classified as having hypertension as a result. So this is maybe an intriguing study, and I think we need more data and maybe more studies to try to figure out if this is something that we might use as an alternative to medication.
Thanks, Henry. I didn't read the study, and I was curious, were these patients already on 2 or 3 medicines and had kind of failed medical therapy before they were entered in the trial?
No, they just took a bunch of individuals. They had to be off of medication. They could have been previously diagnosed and on medication, or they could have been newly diagnosed.
Oh, okay. So they weren't already on medications. Interesting. Because that's typically not the setting we would think about doing something this interventional, is with a group of people who you could just throw on hydrochlorothiazide and lisinopril, for example.
And if you think about it, for those younger individuals, because this was a fairly wide age range, you and I and John, you probably had this as well, where you have a patient says, oh, doc, do I really have to be on medication forever? This might be an alternative.
Yeah, well, that's true. That's true. Well, it's. I think we need more data before I'm going to jump into that. Catheterizations, you know, the cath jockeys think it's no big deal, maybe. I think the wise ones realize the potential things that can go wrong. And so I think we need to be a little cautious. I came up with another word name for your patients, nerveless. They were nerveless. John, any comments?
I'll play the skeptic on this one. I am definitely not impressed by the small amount of blood pressure lowering. And I think that these investigators should give up unless they can show better blood pressure reduction. No way.
Yeah. And I think there was, if I remember correctly, there was also a study on renal artery stenosis where they basically had a failed surgical trial. This was a few years ago. So, you know, This makes perfect theoretical sense. And it's unfortunately probably isn't very impressive in real world practice. There was also a little bit, John or Henry, I think you wanted to add something about the SPRINT trial.
Yeah. So the SPRINT trial, we have talked about it a few times and have pointed out many of the problems in the application of the SPRINT trial and some of the alternative approaches that they went in identifying patients with hypertension. One of our colleagues just recently pointed out some additional problems with the SPRINT trial, including for the control group of patients where their blood pressures were below the threshold. They were actually taken off medication even if they were tolerating it well, which would have actually been inconsistent with the JNC8 recommendations. And so there was a concern that in doing this, you actually may have exposed the control group to more harm and actually stacked the deck to make the intervention look even better.
Thanks for that. Yeah, that was a good point. And I think, was it Dave Slauson that suggested that, if I remember right? Yeah, so Dave's good at finding problems with studies. And as I say this, a bald eagle just flew by. Sorry, listeners, I can't help but comment on that beautiful, mature bald eagle. Anyway, nice. Northern Michigan, gotta love it. Anyway, so this is another problem with the SPRINT trial. You know, in addition to everything we've pointed out in the past, that you would take patients off blood pressure medicine who are already well controlled sure seems like a problem to me. John, your turn.
Yes, I really enjoyed the study about the retesting of the Canadian syncope risk score. So I thought I would include it. This is a study that appeared in JAMA Internal Medicine 2020.
You're not going to try the author's name?
Oh, yes, I am. Yes, I am. I practiced it several times. His name, his last name has nine syllables. Thiragana Sambandamurthy. Not
Very
bad,
good.
Eh?
Wow.
Okay, thank you. Here's the study. The Canadian syncope risk score was previously developed and validated as a prognostic risk tool by the same investigator. I'll call it the CSRS. The CSRS has eight dichotomous elements. First is history suggesting vasovagal syncope, yes or no. History of heart disease, yes or no. Systolic blood pressure less than 90 or greater than 180. Elevated troponin level, again, yes or no. Three EKG elements that I won't list here. And then the emergency room physician's diagnosis of whether this was either vasovagal or cardiac in origin, according to their diagnosis at the time of the visit. And the purpose of this risk assessment tool is to predict the risk of a serious adverse event in the subsequent 30 days, which, by the way, is very useful because the question always is whether these patients should be admitted into the hospital or whether they're low enough risk that they can be sent home for further evaluation. This new evaluation of the CSRS was conducted on nearly 4,000 patients in nine emergency departments across Canada. The authors enrolled consecutive patients 16 years or older who presented within 24 hours of the syncopal episode. The outcomes were assessed later on through medical record and health utilization database analysis and telephone follow-up of each patient, so really extensive follow-up. Here are the outcomes. There were 13 deaths overall, that's 0.3%, and serious outcomes occurred in 3.6% within 30 days. And 77% of these outcomes were arrhythmias. Now, only 0.3%, that's 1 in 333 of the patients at the very low risk, and only 0.7%, that's 1 out of 140 patients at the low risk category, experienced a serious outcome within 30 days. So really pretty accurate at the low risk side. At the other end, 51% of the patients at the very high risk score experienced a serious outcome. So this looks to me like a pretty darn good tool. It's available online. So if you find the article, you can click or you can just look up Google Canadian Syncope Risk Score. And it's really quite an elegant, easy to do score, I would say. It does have eight elements. That's a bit long. Even if you don't have the EKG details, it does perform pretty well. So take a look at this. Although it was validated and developed in the ER, I think it's something that's useful for family physicians.
Thanks, John. And I like my clinical prediction rules. That's what I've done a lot of studies around that. And Essential Evidence Plus, which I edit, one of the things that we created it for was as a showcase for validated clinical prediction rules. We'll be adding this one in the summer. I typically add between 20 and 30 new clinical prediction rules. We already have about, I think, over 500 in there. So if you get Essential Evidence Plus, you can get access to all of these, and they work just fine on your smartphone as well. One interesting thing about this one was the inclusion of overall clinical impression, right? The ER doc's final diagnosis.
Right.
And we did a study recently where we found that that is actually pretty accurate for respiratory infections. That for pneumonia, that's the single best thing you can find is the overall clinical impression, ideally of an experienced physician. Henry?
So syncope, seizure, stroke, if you will, these things that can alter a person's level of consciousness are the bane of many clinicians. And over the past few decades, between many studies, patients, interactions with students, residents, and emergency room physicians, the main point that needs to be made, if you're trying to distinguish among these things, the single most important test, if you will, is the history of the event, including witness observation. And if you forget that, it can lead to all kinds of unnecessary testing, including carotid ultrasounds and things of that nature on the patient with a simple faint. Now, in this case, they used an EKG, which is a perfectly reasonable evaluation of the patient who has fainted, and it adds the prognostic piece. It's not necessarily an aid to diagnosis. It lets us know what happens to these individuals so that, in fact, you can have that conversation with the emergency room physician who is trying to get the person admitted for observation when, in fact, what they probably need is reassurance.
Thanks, Henry. And we're going to close with the answer to the quiz.
So the quiz, once again, was which of the following statements about acute intermittent porphyria is true? One, it is a common, easily diagnosed condition. Two, most patients are symptomatic and frequently experience acute attacks. Three, it is caused by a mutation in genes that encode heme synthesis. Four, no medications have been implicated in triggering acute attacks. So acute intermittent porphyria is a little bit different than the other forms of porphyria in that patients who suffer from this lack the usual photosensitivity, the skin rashes, the blistery rashes, and things of that nature that can occur. In this instance, it's a rare autosomal dominant disorder that's caused by over 100 mutations in the genes that encode heme synthesis. So if you watched 60 Minutes recently, there was it's a little bit unlike sickle cell anemia, where they actually are able to splice a new gene into place with a single codon. This is not necessarily a great candidate for gene therapy. It turns out that the clinical presentation is highly variable and nonspecific. Most patients actually never experience any attacks, but when they do, quite often abdominal pain and heart rate are the most common symptoms. And to add to its confusing nature, during these acute attacks, patients can sometimes experience paranoia and hallucinations. Now, it's during the acute attack that the patient might tell you, you know, when I pee, it turns out that when it's exposed to light, it goes from yellow to dark red. About 90% never experience an acute attack. And it turns out that most gene carriers have no family history because the disease has remained latent for many generations. A number of medications have been implicated in triggering attacks, such as anticonvulsants and barbiturates, can also make the attacks worse. Now, there's some interesting historical components to this, and indicating the family history issue. King George III of England, who was king during the American Revolution, probably suffered from acute intermittent porphyria. There's a fascinating movie, if you haven't seen, called The Madness of King George. It was really based on his unusual behaviors without trying to implicate porphyria. In 1968, one of his descendants was actually reliably diagnosed with porphyria. So that probably nails the diagnosis for King George. Even more fascinating is the speculation that Vlad III, Prince of Wallachia, also suffered from intermittent porphyria. Some may know him better as Vlad the Impaler or by his surname, Dracula. So in this case, the correct answer is three. It's caused by a mutation in genes that encode heme synthesis.
Thanks, Henry. I knew you'd get to Dracula eventually. I just want to make a quick recommendation and then we'll be done. We have been thoroughly enjoying the reboot, kind of the how Perry Mason became Perry Mason set in 1932 LA. When I was a little kid, I would get up every morning in the summer, make a bowl of Special K, because that's the only cereal I was allowed by my German immigrant parents, and watch Perry Mason at 9 a.m. And I loved that show so much. I was like 10 years old, thought it was great. And this is even better, if you can believe. It stars Matthew Rhys from, he's a Welsh actor, and he was in The Americans previously. And the whole thing is reimagined in a really interesting, creative way, and highly recommend it. Anyway, hope you all enjoyed today's discussion. Please tell your friends, spread the word, rate us on iTunes, leave a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can email me at ebell@uga.edu if you have any comments or suggestions. We'll talk to you soon with more primary care updates.